thank you for really the great singing. I'll say this just even before we begin. I love singing new hymns and new songs. And I think I've sung every, I think one that we've sung this weekend was completely new to me. Everything else I at least heard before. I sung in some context. We sing a lot of these in our local church. I love the fact that there are people that are taking on the challenge of writing new songs. I think every generation should do that. I think it's your responsibility to do that. And if you are so gifted, go for it. Just go for it. And just write the words, write the music. Someone else will put something else together. And if it flies, great. If it doesn't, that's fine. Just try again. And because we constantly need new hymns to sing. And really, it's just the overflow of the heart. It's writing psalms, which is the right thing to do. Thanks for being patient over the course of the last three sessions here. I've never tried to do Ruth like this. And so for me, you've been like guinea pigs, and I appreciate anyone that's willing to be a guinea pig. I love this little book. I love this little book because of the way it just works itself out in real life. It talks about real people in real time. And as we go back, we're really going to pick it up in Ruth chapter 3, and we're going to see if we can kind of bring together, from my perspective, every Old Testament narrative has a single climax. And in that climax is found really the timeless truth of the entirety of the story. So we're going to focus on the climax of the book, and I'm going to suggest to you it actually has two climaxes, and you'll kind of see how that works itself out. And in that climax, that's where we find the single truth, and really it's the single truth that we've been saying as far as the totality of the weekend is concerned. All right, separation of two groups of people. There are those that struggle with having a life that's willing to be broken. How can I identify those who struggle with whether that life's going to be broken? Well, I'm going to be able to identify them by their views of particular things. Within their view of God, they view God as working in the lives of others, but not necessarily themselves. So it's not a denial that God's working, but it's a frustration that they don't see God working in them. Second, they focus on the bitterness of present circumstances, not the blessings of the past or the hope of the future. They tend to be individuals that will stop and they will talk a lot about themselves and they'll talk a lot about their present situation. And they're frustrated with that. They're, come on, it's got to get better than this. And they forget that there has been a good God in the past and there are some precious promises as far as the future is concerned. For them, life is very myopic. It's right there. Then finally, the third way I can identify them is they see themselves as the victim of circumstances and worthy of pity. Very self-focused. Talk a lot about themselves. Focus a lot upon their particular situation. And what they're looking for is they're looking for someone else to come alongside and to say, it's just not fair that God is treating you this way. Now, they might not verbalize it in particularly that way, making the accusation against deity. But nonetheless, the spirit of it is there. Right. Those are the characteristics of a life that's unwilling to be broken. That shell is still there. Then there are characteristics of an individual that has a broken life. And they're not fancy. There's nothing new being said here. This is just a girl in her mid-20s, maybe late 20s, who's getting up in the morning and going to work. And as she gets up and as she goes to work, there are certain theological truths that are being enacted in her life. What are they? Number one, she's taking steps of faith. She's taking initiative. She's willing to get outside of her comfort zone and just do it. Do something. Number two, she works hard in sovereign silence. The prayer that Sherry sang and that we prayed together as she was singing it, that's a life that's willing to be broken. Lord, in the dark times, in the silent times, I'm still in the marketplace. I'm still in the field. I'm still gleaning. I'm still working. Why? Because I trust you. Even in those silent times. Number three, they deal with difficulty without discouragement. Again, we saw that in three different places. Don't rebuke her. Don't reproach her. Don't hoot at her. Leave her alone. Now, she stayed in the field in the process. So she's willing to deal with difficulties by way of Ruth. Number four, there's an expression of gratitude for each gift. And what I love about this, and I said something about this earlier, but a person who has a life that's willing to be broken, every good gift they receive, they don't feel like they deserve. That's a heart of humility. So anytime something is given to them, they respond by going, wow, look at this. Fantastic, God. Man, you people are so gracious. You don't see Ruth going, it's about time. I mean, I've been out here all day. I came all the way from Moab with this woman who is old and bitter right now. It's about time. Finally, someone came up, patted me on the back and said, good job, girl. No, the minute she got something, she was like, she falls on her face and she says, who am I? I'm a foreigner. I don't deserve anything. Hey, that's a life that evidences brokenness. She serves others and not self. Even in the midst of her labor, she's putting something away for Naomi that's back home. She trusts in God's protection and provision. And then finally, the last one, and I'll just throw this out because you're going to start seeing a transition here within Naomi's life. Pick it up in chapter 2. End of where we kind of left off here in verse 20. Ruth comes back, gives the story, and suddenly Naomi says something that she's never said. She says this, blessed be the Lord. Do you see that anywhere else in Naomi's life? Chapter 1, not there. Beginning of chapter 2, not there. Now suddenly, it is Ruth's influence. She comes back, tells the story of what God's done, and now Naomi starts to look up and she says, wow, this God who has dealt bitterly with me, this God whose hand is against me, now blessed be the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and to the dead. A person whose life has been broken influences others, directs their eyes vertically. And suddenly Naomi stops and she starts to, instead of looking at self, she starts to look up and she says, wow, I got a big God. I've got a big God. Now, chapter 3. I love chapter 3. All right, let's go back to our dramatic illustration here. Chapter 1, scene goes up, or curtain goes up, scene is set, everything is pitch black, cellos are playing, probably basses are playing. Again, we have the departure out of Bethlehem, Judah, into Moab. There are a couple of moments of violins playing when the funeral, where the weddings take place. Then it's followed by three funerals, and then the slow march back. And as they march back, you have the women greeting them, and then you have Naomi rejecting that greeting and saying, call me Mara. At that point in time, curtain comes down, and the entire scene has been dark and sad and somber. Chapter 2, curtain goes back up. Scene's completely different. Lights are bright. Violins are playing. Trumpets are playing. It's harvest time. God has smiled upon his people. Now people are moving around on stage. Everyone's happy. Everyone's singing. And as they're singing, this poor little girl goes out. And as she goes out, she goes into the field and she haps to light upon a particular field. And as she haps to light on that particular field, suddenly God in his grace brings Boaz along and Boaz protects her. And we have the scene of chapter 2. Curtain goes down. Chapter 3. Just like chapter 1, curtain goes up, pitch black on stage. Spotlight goes on over in the corner. You have Naomi and you have Ruth huddled together in their little home. Probably basses and cellos are playing, low music, maybe some low brass at this point in time. And a conversation begins to take place. Now, this is what you've got to do for me. Please forget the rest of the story. Okay? Just forget what happens in Ruth 4. Just forget it. Pretend like you're reading it for the very first time. And let's go back to what we did this morning. This is the time of the judges. Every man's doing what's right in his own eyes. This is a woman from Moab.
A land that is known for its incestuous relationships. A land that is known for its immorality. A land that is known for its absolute abhorrence of Jehovah God. This is the time of harvest. A time when immorality is usually rampant in the land. This is a time of levirate marriage. Matter of fact, last time you had a situation like this, it was actually the story in Genesis 38. Remember the story? I'll just tell it for you quickly. We won't even turn there. It's again one of those kind of sad stories. Judah marries a Canaanite, has three boys. The first one marries a girl by the name of Tamar. There's only two times in Scripture where it says, and God killed someone. The first time it says that is in Genesis 28, where the first husband of Tamar does that which is displeasing in the sight of God, and it says, God killed him. So, what does Judah do? Judah takes his second son, his name is Onan, gives him to Tamar and says, bring up a child in the name of your older brother. Levirate marriage. And Onan goes into Tamar and he refuses to impregnate her. Second time where it says, and God kills someone. Onan now drops dead. Two down. There's a third brother, his name's Shelah, just a boy at this time. Judah says, Tamar, you go back home and I'll give you Shelah after he grows up. But he had no intent at all at giving Shelah to Tamar. He just lost two boys. He's not about ready to lose a third. Remember the story? Shelah grows up, marries. Judah forgets all about Tamar. He goes to the harvest time and the sheep shearing. He comes back from that time. Tamar dresses herself up like a prostitute, ends up seducing him. They, as they're together, she gets impregnated. He hears about it and says, let's go burn Tamar. He runs to her house and Tamar steps out and says, you're right, I'm pregnant. And I am pregnant by the man who owns. And she pulls out his staff and his signet ring, which she took from him. And all of a sudden, Judah goes, oops. That's really interesting, actually, what it says in the text. It says, she has been more righteous than I have been. And then Tamar gives birth to twins. Okay? Time of harvest, time of sheep shearing, time of seduction and immorality. Okay. Original readers, they read the first five verses of this little book. Now they're in chapter 3. And Naomi starts to scheme a plot. Let's read it. Naomi, her mother-in-law, says to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? In other words, hey, it's time for you to get married. Right? That's the plot. Verse 2, now Boaz, whose young woman you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, and don't miss what she's saying here. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself. Put on your best garment. Go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known unto the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, you shall notice the place where he lies down. You shall go in, uncover his feet, lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. Folks, we view this scene sometimes, I think, with Victorian eyes. Take the Victorian spectacles off. This is a scene that has all the language of seduction. And that's exactly what the first readers would have expected. This is the time of the judges. Every man was doing what's right in his own eyes. This is a Moabitess. This is a levirate marriage situation. This is at night. Now, I don't know what Naomi was thinking. But she tells a young lady to put on your best outfit, clean yourself up, put on your best perfume, go down in the middle of the night to a threshing floor where there is a single man. And after he has done eating and drinking, remember the Lot story, remember the Judah story. Every single reader in the Old Testament would have. Then you lay yourself at his feet and you say, "Here I am, you do what you will." That's Naomi's advice. And quite honestly, it can't be read any other way. And the original readers, and if you were reading this for the first time, my guess is that your heart would do the same thing that my heart would do. And in our hearts, we would say, "Oh, no. No. Not another one in Bethlehem, Judah. I'm starting to like these people. I mean, I'm reading this story, and I like Ruth. And I like Boaz. Is this thing going to end the same way every story in Judges and every story in Bethlehem, Judah, and every story about Moab ends? Is that what's going to happen?" So immediately the hearts of the readers just start to turn at this point because their expectations have already been established via their understanding of Old Testament history. That's the plot. Ruth's actions. Verse 5. "And she said to her, 'All that you say to me, I'll do.'" Ruth, in innocence, says, "Naomi, I'll submit." So she goes in, she cleans herself up. She gets out her best perfume, she perfumes herself. She does her hair just right, she puts on her best garment. She moves out. Verse 6. "She went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunken and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came softly and she uncovered his feet and then she lay down there." Now we're building to the climax. And we're about ready to find out what this story is all about. By the way, why did she uncover his feet? Why did she uncover his feet? What do you do at a threshing floor? Thresh. You thresh. Okay? So, what? It's like defining a word by a word. I don't think you're allowed to do that. So, what's threshing? You take the wheat, you throw it up in the air, and then the wind blows and it separates the grain from the chaff, and the chaff blows away. So, with that in mind, every threshing floor is going to be in a location where there's a breeze blowing. It's absolutely necessary to have a breeze if you're at a threshing floor. So why do you think she uncovered his feet? Wake him up. She's not going to lay there all night. And so, you know, she goes, she uncovers his feet. He's sitting there. And at midnight, finally, his feet are cold. And it's great. Because this is like real life. "It happened now at midnight," verse 8, "that the man was startled and he turned and there was a woman lying at his feet." Have you ever woken up and felt like someone else is in the room looking at you? Like, this is it. He's here lying and all of a sudden he wakes up at midnight and there's just, he's startled. The word is, can be translated, he's fearful. And his feet are cold, and he looks down, and it's like, uh-oh, who is that? Who is that? Now, I just note a couple things here. Why do you think Boaz is by himself? I doubt he was eating and drinking by himself. He's probably eating and drinking with everyone else. But he separated himself for a reason. And it begs the question about where everyone else was. He did not expect anyone else to be there. I'm going to suggest to you that that was the beginning of his integrity. He could have been with the other men, and he wasn't. He looks down. There's this woman at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" Now, he assumes that she's awake, which I think is interesting.
He just asked the question, who are you? And she says, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Same exact term that's used in chapter 2 when she says, who am I? I'm not worthy to be your maidservant. Now she says, now I'm your maidservant. And I love what she does here. She says, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. In essence, she doesn't get down on one knee. She's laying out on the floor, and she says, here I am, marry me. Take me under your wing. And what she's doing is she's actually using his words against him. Flip back with me to chapter 2. Verse 12, Boaz says this about the responsibility of the Lord. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. So earlier, 4 months earlier, Boaz says, Ruth, you're a wonderful girl. May the Lord reward you and put you under his wings. And now she's laying at his feet going, all right, why we're talking about wings here? Let's take this theological truth of being underneath the Lord's wings, and you're the close relative. You put me under your wing. Now, here's the key. Time of the judges, middle of the night, woman at his feet saying, marry me. And not just marry me, but with the nuance of you're a close relative, you have a responsibility to bring up a child through me in the name of my former husband. Let me just say this. Every other man in Israel would have done one thing. And Boaz doesn't. He doesn't. Boaz says no. Not no to the marriage, but no to the temptation. And if you think for a moment the temptation wasn't there, you're wrong. Every other man would have done what was right in his own eyes. But not Boaz. This is his response. Verse 10. And he said, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter. For you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning. And that you did not go after the young, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all of the people of my town know that you're a virtuous woman. Folks, just grab this just for a moment. This is the absolute climax of this story. Boaz looks at her and says, I will fulfill my obligation before God. And I will do all that you ask by way of marriage. Because you're a virtuous woman. Don't fear. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to touch you. I'm not going to do what any other man in this town would have done. You rest. You're virtuous. And I'm a man of integrity. I love this story because this is the story of this is an old farmer, an old bachelor farmer who by age, he defines himself as old and she is young. We already know she's probably in her late 20s, maybe early 30s at best, which would probably put him in mid 40s, let's say, maybe early 50s. And for all of those years, he has walked before God in integrity, having the same hopes, dreams, expectation of any young man growing up,
but waiting on God to fulfill those expectations in his timing. And now at this point in his life, when this final temptation comes, when every other man would have done it, he says, "Don't fear. I won't hurt you. I'll take care of you. And you're a blessed woman." She, we've already talked about her. 28, 29, maybe 30. Lived out her life in barrenness, in desperation, with death surrounding her. She lays at his feet. And as she lays at his feet, his response to her is, "You're a virtuous woman and everybody in this town knows it. I couldn't touch you because of who you are." By the way, this term virtuous is only used twice in the entire Old Testament. Here and where else? Proverbs 31. In the Hebrew Old Testament, the book of Ruth follows the book of Proverbs. So you want to know what the Proverbs 31 woman looks like? It looks like the book of Ruth. That's what it looks like. It's the only time those two terms are used. Now, I love the kicker with this. In the darkest days of Israel's history, there is a man of integrity and there is a woman of virtue. Then Boaz throws the curveball in. And this is where the double climax comes in. So he says, "Now it's true, verse 12, that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that he will perform, if he shall perform the duty of a close relative for you, good, let him do it." What did he just say to Ruth? Just in practical terms. He said, "You know what? You're right. I'm a close relative, and I'd love to marry you. But there's actually a relative who's closer than I am. So tomorrow morning, I'll introduce you to him. And if he wants you, well then, good. He can marry you." What are you thinking if you're Ruth? That's like a serious ouch. She's laying there, and she's just really thrown herself at this guy's feet, and he has said, "You're a virtuous woman." And then he said, "Oh, but by the way, there's a relative who's closer than I am, and if he wants you, good. He can have you." Hey, what would you do if you were Ruth in that situation? I mean, I'd slap him. That's exactly what I'd do. I would get up and I would go, "Whack! What are you talking about, boy? I mean, I am here right now at your feet." The other thing I'd do if I were Ruth, I'd be thinking two other things. One, I'd be wanting to go after Naomi. Hey, Naomi, don't you know your own family genealogy? Don't you know your own family tree? Why am I doing laying at this guy's feet when there's someone else running around? The other thing that I'm doing is this. I'm sitting there thinking, this is only a town of 5,000 people. If I'm Ruth, I'm sitting there the rest of the night in my mind going, "Who is this other guy?" And every face is rolling through this Rolodex in my mind going, "Is it him? No, he's not related. Is it him? No, I don't think he's related. Is it him? No, I don't think he's related." So the rest of the night, Ruth is laying there. Do you think she slept that night?
No.
Are you kidding? He's just told her that tomorrow she's getting married. She just doesn't know who the groom is. That's all. So don't worry about it, Ruth. Tomorrow you're getting married. If it's him, good. If it's not, good. I'll take you. That's the story. Continue reading. The end of verse 13. "But if he does not want to perform the duty, then I will perform the duty for you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning." He protects her integrity.
I'm not going to let you run back in the middle of the night. I'm not going to put you in a position where others may somehow touch you. I'm not going to question if you're caught up here at night and we're together, that's not a problem. Because everyone sees that I am lying here and you are lying there and there's no physical contact. But if you walk down at night, then there's going to be questions. You stay here. I will protect you as a woman of virtue. Continues verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. Then he said, don't let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the shawl that is on you and hold it. And she held it, and he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. Can I just stop here just for a moment? And again, because I love all the details of a story. 6 ephahs of wheat. You know how much that is? It's somewhere probably between 65 and 72 pounds. She lays out a shawl. He dumps in 65 to 72 pounds of grain, ties it up. She reaches down, deadlifts this thing, throws it over her shoulder, and then hauls it back into the city. Okay? Now, again, the reason I say that is I just, sometimes when we read Old Testament narratives, we have this idea that all of these people are, you know, that we picture Ruth as this nice little petite Jewish girl with dark hair and dark eyes, or a Moabite girl, and, you know, this girl can deadlift, all right, 70 pounds, throw it over her shoulder, and then march down into the city. She is a woman of the rocks. All right? And I say that because Moab is known as the place of the rocks. Her beauty is not found necessarily in her physicality. Her beauty is found in her character. This is a working girl. It's a simple, plain working girl. She throws this bag over her shoulder. She marches back into the city. And I absolutely love, if you catch nothing else out of this, guys in particular, at least catch this piece of simple wisdom out of the lips of Boaz. Verse 16, and she came to her mother-in-law and said, is that you, my daughter? Then she told him all that the man had done for her, and she said, these 6 ephah of barley he gave to me, for he said, and here's your simple wisdom, do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Okay, guys, if you get nothing else out of this story, all right, that's one verse that you should memorize. Don't go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So Boaz has some simple wisdom that he's working with here. And Naomi's response is simply this, sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. And that's the end. Now, we could go into chapter 4, and we don't need to. In chapter 4, Boaz pulls the classic bait and switch. You want the land? Yeah, great, you get the woman with it. Don't want the woman, then I don't want the land. You can have the land. You can have the woman. Boaz takes the land, takes the woman, acts in complete integrity in the process. And now what I want you to see is just at the end here, for the first time, you get to see God start to act. Everything else has been Lord haps this to happen, or someone else says, God did this. Suddenly the Lord actually becomes the subject of verbs. Pick it up in verse 11. The people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord, here's the prayer, make the woman who's coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Ephraim, that they may prosper in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, with whom Tamar, remember that? Born of Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you through this young woman. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her. Now the Lord is the subject of the verbs. And the Lord gave her conception. And she bore a son. Let me ask a simple question here, then we'll see if we can wrap this up. What if God would have answered Naomi's prayer for the 10 years that she was married and would have provided the child for her? This story would have never happened because there would have been no need for Boaz. For 10 years, no doubt in my mind, she prayed, Lord, give me a child. And for 10 years, the Lord said, no, I have a better plan for you. I'm just not going to tell you yet. But when God's time was perfect, he opens up her womb and gives conception. The child. Let's go down to the genealogy in verse 18. Now, this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begat Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Abinadab. Abinadab, Nashon. Nashon, Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz. Boaz begat Obed. Obed begat Jesse. Jesse begat David. There's only four women that are mentioned in Matthew chapter 1. In the genealogy of Christ. Ruth is number two. And it says, and Boaz begot Jesse of Ruth, and Jesse begot David, the king. The king. All right, what do we take from all this? What do we take from it all? I think we stop and we say this. There are the Elliots. There are the Nate Saints. There are the Hudson Taylors. There are the Adoniram Judsons of this world who in simple faith died to self and God used them in remarkable ways. And we read their stories today. But those aren't the only people that understand that to have a fruitful life, you have to have a selfless death. There are teachers, there are factory workers, there are truck drivers, there are people who flip burgers every day, there are people who work in secretarial offices, there are students that are in college, there are, if I can use this term, average Joes and average Janes. Just like Boaz, just like Ruth, who every single day go to work and they allow themselves to be crushed. They maintain their integrity. They maintain their virtue. When everyone else in the world is doing it, even in the dark when no one would catch them, they say no. And they don't know why. Let me rephrase that. They don't know what the end will be. Right? Ruth has no idea that David's going to be her great-grandchild. But that's really not the issue. The issue is they answer to a God that they believe in, that they trust, that they love. And he's a kind God. I won't take us back through the text. Twice Boaz refers to God as a kind God. Twice Ruth responds to the kindness of God. These are two individuals. And if I can put them in a New Testament context, this is what I would say about them. These are two individuals who are absolutely saturated with the grace of God in their life.
They know what God, what Christ did for them on Calvary. They understand the gracious gift, and their lives are so gospel-centered. Their lives are so God-centered. Their lives are so God-saturated that everything that they do in life, whether it is gleaning in the field or whether it is walking in the marketplace, everything that they do is between them and God, and they don't care what anyone else is thinking, and they don't care what anyone else is doing, and they really don't even care what the end game is. They don't care what the consequences are, because they answer to God and they answer to God alone. And for that reason, they will do what's right with incredible joy. And God uses those type of people in His sovereign plan to produce fruit. God uses you if you're that type of person to produce fruit. Now, I don't know what that fruit's going to look like. Quite honestly, you don't either. You don't know who your great-grandchild's going to be. You don't know who you may impact in the workplace, who may have a great-grandson who does something at a large level. But who cares? It's really not the issue. The amount of the fruit, the place of the fruit, the nature of the fruit doesn't matter. What matters is what happens to the seed. And you're the seed. That's where your responsibility lies. Boaz and Ruth planted themselves in the ground where God placed them, allowed themselves to be crushed. The fruit eventually was David. You allow yourself to be placed in the ground wherever God has you. Allow yourself to be crushed. And what the fruit is, boy, won't it be fun when you get to heaven and find out? I'm really, really hoping that somehow God in His grace has like a divine DVD of my life and all the fruits thereof. I hope He does for you in a very positive way, where you stop and you go, okay, Leon, this is what I lived. I tried to do what was right by Your grace in every situation. God, what'd you do with this poor little seed? What'd you do with it? What orchards came? What saplings developed? Lord, did I die right so that fruit can continue? My goal this weekend was just really, really simple. It's one truth. And if you walk away from 2 days with one truth, and if it's emblazed within your heart, supported by this simple little story, I think God will be pleased. For there to be a fruitful life, there has to be a selfless death. If you doubt it, read Ruth. And let that be an encouragement for you in the marketplace of life tomorrow, the day after that, and for the rest of your life. Let's pray. Father, thank You for this wonderful little book, for the truths that are found within it, and we pray that it would be an encouragement to us in all things. And we'll give You thanks in Your name. Amen.